Blokes in blouses blogging about blobfish. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 183. And of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your jazzy puzzlers, guzzling pizza and nuzzling bedazzled buzzers. Huzzah.
Huzzah. I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
Those all have double Z's.
Yeah.
It looks cool when I write it down.
But then
when you say it, it's different.
You gotta
all those words
people.
Have double Z's.
A lot of pizzazz.
Yeah. Also, cameo from Blobfish. I think about.
Yeah.
When you say the word blobfish, I think about what it looks like. That face, and it just cracks.
You know,
me up.
I feel like we are actually had a little mini blobfish renaissance in the last few months. You know,
blobfish is just having a moment.
It was a little bit of a moment.
All right, exciting follow up, listeners. If you and I don't know if you guys remember last episode on our pop quiz hotshot, we had a silver chalice card. It was a card filled with
two questions, at least.
Yeah.
And two questions. It wasn't filled with questions.
It felt like a lot of questions.
And it was like biblical in theme. And also we're like, what is the silver chalice? And we actually said, probably most people know more about this than we do because we don't know that much about the Bible. I have follow up. A lot of people tweeted and emailed and Facebook posted and this email in particular from David. And he said, in your latest episode, Dress You Up, you all were discussing the silver chalice and the Last Supper. And Dana said, quote, I bet people who are more familiar with the Bible will be like, what, you guys? We're going to get some actuallys. So David says, here is mine. I have a master in divinity. Both of my parents are ordained ministers. I graduated top of my class in seminary. I won an award for my biblical translations. I had to get a bookcase specifically for my Bibles, and I read the Bible daily. And I have never heard of the silver chalice, either the film or as a biblical reference. Huh. There is reference to Jesus' cup in three of the Gospels, but most translations just use the word cup and not chalice. Try to look for it. And he goes, actually, so no, actually from the biblical point of view.
All right.
Yay. Yeah.
Wow.
Silver chalice seems like some biblical interpretation gone awry.
Very Hollywoodized, perhaps.
Yeah. And then I looked up the movie starring Paul Newman, which was, you know, in the trivia card. He was commissioned to make the silver chalice for the Last Supper. So it was historical. Mm. It was fictional as well.
All right. Thanks for doing so much extra research for us there. Yeah.
My reaction as I'm reading down that email, like of his list of accolades, I was like, oh no.
Oh, it's going to be like a slam dunk.
Yay!
When you, bookshelf is about the silver.
Had to buy a new bookshelf. To hold my many versions.
Yeah. Good job, guys.
Yeah. All right. Good job not knowing about stuff.
And with that said, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. Here I have Trivia Pursuit 1995.
Ooh, okay. What do you mean? It's the year 19. It's all the questions are about the year 1995 or this
we've
card?
Had one from this set before, I think, right?
This is about 1995.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Perfect.
Okay.
All right.
Those 365 days. All right, here we go. Pink Wedge. What outfit looked over 22,000 entries from its, quote, Yo, I'm your CEO contest, then selected a candidate found by a headhunter?
Oh.
Oh, okay.
I don't really get this question.
I think I know.
I think it, is it monster.com?
No.
Hmm. What? Okay.
A little too early.
Yo,
for that.
Yo, I'm your CEO, and there were many different entries, but then it just picks someone from a headhunter.
Like an actual CEO and not a random
CEO.
Is it MTV?
No.
I wanted to say MTV because MTV
raps.
Yo,
I'm your CEO.
It sounds like something desperately trying to be youth appeal.
I feel like it's you know it or you don't. It is Ben and Jerry's.
Huh. Okay.
Why did they call it Yo, like yogurt? Well, why did they call it Yo? I'm your CEO.
Because it rhymes with CEO.
CEO.
Yo, I'm your CEO.
Wow. So like they're about puns, not
good ice cream though.
Yeah, right.
Good ice cream though. Yeah.
It was
yeah.
the '90s.
Bad campaigns.
Yellow Wedge. What European nation forced CompuServe to block access to explicit news groups?
Oh.
Oh, it was between Colin and Chris. I'm going to give it to Colin.
Germany.
Correct. Mm. Correct.
Mm. They're all about blocking access to stuff. Even back then. I don't think you could buy Doom in Germany.
Like, yeah.
When Doom came out.
They don't like bloody video games.
They don't.
Right?
All right, Brown Wedge. What 1995 movie was the first film to feature characters who attend weekly, quote, plastic corrosion awareness meetings? Wow. Colin again.
Toy Story?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Of course.
I didn't remember. I don't remember that 1995.
Either. That's quite a throwaway gag from Toy Story.
I don't remember that bit.
Orange Wedge, what did Giorgio Armani declare to be the most elegant and intelligent color?
Huh.
Dana.
Black?
Correct. It is black. Right. Simple and minimalist. Teal Wedge, what software billionaire?
It's pronounced billiards. It's billiards.
Billiards air.
Billionaire.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
Billionaire.
No,
no, I billionaire. Can't do it.
Like a funny billionaire.
What software billionaire?
No.
What? Wow.
Whatever. Yeah.
Very rich person.
Okay, there's a hole.
Gave Jimi Hendrix's dad an interest-free loan to sue for the rights to his son's music and master discs.
Oh,
I'm gonna give it to Chris.
Bill Gates.
Incorrect.
It's gotta be. It's gotta be Paul Allen. He's a huge Hendrix fan,
really?
Guitar fan. Yeah.
There were only two software billionaires in 1995. So.
Have you guys been to the Experience Music Project in Seattle?
No, it's, but I heard about
it. It's actually pretty cool. Yeah,
it's like a museum,
and funded.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, in large part or exclusively by Paul Allen.
Really?
Huge amount of money, and a lot of his guitars from his personal collection are there. It's pretty neat.
I heard it's a really cool museum.
Yeah,
all right,
it's pretty neat.
Last question, Blue Wedge. What senior PGA veteran teed off a 24-hour cable TV channel devoted to golf?
Poor Brewster. Is it Jack Nicklaus?
No.
Is it Arnold Palmer?
It is Arnold Palmer. I was like, come on, we all know this name.
Yeah.
It's beverage.
Cool. I'm more sad about the rooster buzzer.
So sad.
Yeah.
You know, we can put a new battery in there.
Well, technically, yeah.
It's dead forever. All right, good job, brains. Colin, what are we talking about this week?
Today. Well, I've had a story that I've been sitting on in my trivia vault for a while, trying to find a way that I could work it into Good Job
in
Brain.
In your brain.
Yes, in my
not
brain.
Not in like a real...
It's not an actual vault. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not anymore. The first one burned down. It was terrible. Yeah, I lost so much trivia. And then concurrently, we just passed Memorial Day. Memorial Day, remembering people who have performed service to our nation. I was thinking about awards and honors, and I was watching on the news. There was a serviceman that had the giant row of the medals pinned to his chest, and thinking about how hard it is, to remember what each little one, all the different colors. So I went and I kind of fell down a wiki hole on military awards, and we may have a little bit of that coming up later.
We get that in trivia sometimes.
We do.
Like what. Is the Purple Heart for?
We do.
Or what award do people win? I was like,
right.
All ribbons and stars.
And so that tied into this little trivia story that I have been sitting on, which I will share for you guys a little bit later in the show. And I thought we would open it up and talk about awards, medals, decorations, anything that you earn or is awarded to you, but something around the idea of a prize or something you did to earn it.
So this week, let's keep our eyes on the prize.
All I do is win, 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 no matter what. Got money on my mind, I can never get enough. And every time I step up in the building, everybody hands go up. And they stay there.
Now, when you think of the ultimate prize being awarded to someone who has starred in a movie, you, of course, think of the Oscars.
Yeah.
But we've had way too many Oscar quizzes.
Yeah.
So I want to actually talk about a different award that is given.
And
we don't actually know anything. A different award that every now and again sometimes comes up and crosses through our field of vision that are given to people who have acted in that year's films, colloquially known as The Razzies. The Golden Raspberry Awards, nice. To be particular about it. And the award, the trophy itself is indeed a raspberry, you know, sort of a statue of a raspberry painted with cheap gold paint. It began in 1981, honoring films released in 1980 and honoring what are considered to be, the worst movies released, over the course of a year, usually held right before the Oscars. The biggest difference between the Oscars and the Razzies, now the Razzies last year were held in the Palace Theater in Los Angeles. I mean, it's a big deal.
Do the winners even show up?
So here's the thing. Not often. 99% of the time, no, the winners do not show up, but that's only 99% of the time. So this is a quiz about the Razzie winners who graciously, with no shortage of good humor, actually showed up at Razzie ceremonies over the years to accept their worst actor or worst picture or what have you award in person.
Oh, okay. So it's not like the nominees show up and they're awaiting for them to announce the worst.
I hope I'm the worst. Bunch.
Actually, I don't think that they tell them that they've won. I think they will. I think they sort of assume that they're going to win and they show, you know, quote unquote win, and they show up and they accept.
They have
the
their
award.
Well-placed sources within the Razzie. Yeah.
There have been people who have said, so basically, if I say I'm going
to
be there, you
give
vote,
it to me.
You're going to vote for me, right? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much. Yeah, yes. That seems to be how it goes, but I'm not quite sure. So here we go. So get your buzzers ready. I won't put the rooster into service. He's had a tough day already. The first person to ever show up to collect a Razzie in person accepted the Worst Actor Award for a 1987 parody of spy movies. Nate, tell me the actor and the film.
James Coburn?
Incorrect. Colin.
William Shatner.
No.
Okay, what's a spy parody?
A parody of spy films released in 1987, generally considered the worst thing that this actor comedian has ever done. Generally considered one of the worst movies. Always pops up on your list of terrible films.
No, it's not.
It must be like a Bond parody.
Maybe. Is it a Pink Panther?
It's not quite
Panther
a Bond
were good
parody.
Movies, though.
I will tell you the actor, and then you will probably know the movie. The actor's name is Bill Cosby.
I was going to say Bill Cosby.
And the film is?
Not Leonard Part 6.
It is Leonard
Part 6? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Leonard
I was just thinking,
Part 6. Okay. There's no Leonard's Parts 1 through 5.
The only reason I didn't say that is I couldn't imagine him actually having enough self-effacing humor to show up and accept it.
He actually did show up and accept the award. All
right.
Yep. Okay. All right. Let's shake it off.
That was hard. I've never heard
that
movie
before. Okay. Here's a slightly easier one.
Okay.
The 2001 film Freddy Got Fingered took home 5 Razzies for whom? Dana.
Tom Green.
Tom Green, who brought his own red carpet to the ceremony.
That's awesome.
Yep. This actress accepted her award in person for a comic book-based movie.
Oh.
Colin.
I believe that was Halle Berry.
That was indeed Halle
from
Berry.
Catwoman.
Execrable. Yep. Catwoman.
Oh my god, so she's been Catwoman and Storm.
Yeah.
Oh.
Who would win her?
She accepted the award while holding her Oscar for Best Actress in Monsters Ball, which she'd gotten a few years before.
There can't be many people who have won both.
not a whole lot, no. In 2004, Ben Affleck was nominated for the Worst Actor Razzie for 3 different films, all of which came out in 2003.
Okay.
All right.
I know one.
Well, I was going to get, okay. Well, yeah, sure. Let's go. Let's go around. Let's see if you can get them all. Yes.
Daredevil.
Daredevil. Mm-hmm. Yes, Dana.
Oh.
This leaves Colin with the last one.
I know what
you guys
the last
give me the
one
hard
is.
One.
Yep.
Geely, Daredevil. Man, that wasn't Dogma.
Yeah.
Jersey Girl.
It's not Jersey Girl. It was Paycheck. Paycheck, Daredevil, and Geely. Yeah.
It's just a very, like, whatever movie. I wouldn't put it on, like,
you know,
the worst
wasn't
movies,
that based
you know?
On
I think they rolled it all into,
I think,
know.
Yeah, those 3 in a row, though. You're like,
all in one year.
What are you up to? Yeah.
Director Paul Verhoeven accepted the Worst Picture Award for what NC-17 film? Karen.
Showgirls.
Showgirls.
I'm a dancer.
In 1993, this mustachioed actor, famously mustachioed actor, accepted the Worst Supporting Actor Razzie for his role in the film Christopher Columbus, The Discovery. Worst Supporting Actor.
93.
You said mustachioed?
Famously.
Tom Selleck.
Tom Selleck is it.
Tom Selleck or Tom Skerritt.
I was like, Tom Skerritt. Sometimes Tom Skerritt shaves. Yeah. Tom Selleck, never. Brian Helgeland accepted the Worst Screenplay Award for his work on this 1997 bomb, directed by and produced by Kevin Costner.
Oh.
Colin.
Would that be Waterworld?
It is not Waterworld.
Oh.
That was a little earlier. That was 94, I think-ish.
The Postman?
The Postman, yes.
That's
the Postman. Costner did not show up.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock famously showed up at the Razzies in 2010 to accept the Worst Actress Award for All About Steve. Oh, the next night, she won the Best Actress Academy Award for what film? Dana.
The Blind Side?
The Blind Side. Indeed, The Blind Side.
It was the night before?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Razzies, that's
awesome.
She got
the Worst Actress, Best Actress.
Yeah.
I think they ensure good publicity if they do it that
way.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's how they glom
like
on to the Oscars.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then once the Oscars are over, nobody cares about the Razzies. But if it's in the run-up to the Oscars, then it gets that, you know, mention. Final question. A writer named J. David Shapiro, J.D. Shapiro, appeared at the Razzies twice. Once to accept the award for Worst Screenplay for a film released in the year 2000, and then again in the year 2011 to accept the award for Worst Picture of the Decade for the same film.
Oh,
that's a towering achievement.
And what was that film? So I'm asking you, what did they say in 2011 was the worst film of the decade going back to the year 2010?
Oh, is it like a big blockbuster movie or is it?
It was a movie. It was a big movie that you've heard of.
Worst movie.
It was pretty famously terrible.
The Room?
Not The Room. No.
Crossroads. It's gotta be something. Yeah. It's gotta be something that was expensive and bad.
Expensive, bad, self-indulgent, ridiculous, the epitome of terrible filmmaking.
2001 was the original.
2000.
Is it when it came out? Can we get a genre? 2000.
It was a science fiction film. Karen.
After Earth.
It is not After Earth.
No, sorry.
Karen.
I'm thinking of the John Travolta one.
Uh-huh.
God, it's not After Earth. Beyond Earth? Beyond.
Colin?
Chris, is it Battlefield Earth?
It is indeed Battlefield Earth, starring John Travolta.
Wow.
Worst picture of the decade.
Wow. I only made it about 20 minutes into that one.
I don't think I've watched any of these movies that were.
Well,
you
good
didn't
for
watch
you.
Catwoman?
I didn't watch Catwoman.
Oh. Woo! Yeah. I just have a quick tidbit before I forget, because I saw this in the headlines. Well, I'm a big – I don't know if you guys listeners know, but I'm a very big pizza enthusiast. Pizza is my favorite food, not because of Ninja Turtles, but that really helped. And I didn't even put that together.
Huh? I
think as a kid I watched it. I was like, wow, that's so American. I want to eat pizza too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then, do you like remember the first time you had pizza?
American pizza coming here. Yeah, I remember the day I had my first American slice. Blondie's Pizza on Telegraph Avenue.
That was
That was my first.
Wow. That's an intense pizza to start with.
And I never went anywhere else. Was like, that is still that moment. Just a normal cheese pizza. Oh, pizza's my favorite food. I even I've mentioned before, I started a whole running club dedicated to pizza and running. And so I had no idea that there are the Pizza World Championships. I know, granted, there's contests for everything, but there's the world, it's the Olympics of pizza.
For making it or for eating it?
For making it.
Okay.
It's almost like a lot of other, the baking competition or the cake competition. So every country has a team. it's like the Olympics where it's not like one event. There's multiple events. So you have to build out your country's team. So there's like dough stretching. And so you have your dough stretcher who's really good at dough stretching for Team USA or Team Italy or Team France. And then you have your kind of classic pizza cooking competition, your not classic. And then you have different like, oh, pizza for two and like just a lot of events.
Question. How far did you go in the research? Cause I have so many questions about dough stretching competition.
You know, I went as far enough as until everything was in Italian, I couldn't really read it.
Okay. All right.
Like, cause all the
deep pizza web.
The news headlines, they're all kind of like reworded PR blasts.
And like, what are they measuring with the dough stretching? Yeah. Is it like everybody gets the same amount of dough?
I think so.
See how much, and how big no you can get it. No hole. Yeah. I have lots of follow up questions.
I know. I feel, and I was like, maybe there's a documentary or maybe there's like, they should really broadcast this in the news. Anyways.
Okay.
So you would think, Italy, and Italy does win a lot of the events, and they win a lot of the, you know, every year. But this past year, it was France. France won with their bouillabaisse pizza.
Get out of here.
Bouillabaisse, which is a Provençal southern fish stew, like a peasanty fisherman's fish stew flavored pizza. And they won.
I'm skeptical.
They beat out. I mean, number two and number three were Italy, but number one was France, and that's a pretty big deal.
I'm sure they're not going to let Italy forget it either.
And then, the classic margarita competition, Australia took number one.
Oh, wow.
So
this is like the California wine.
Yeah.
You know,
France versus France.
Wine competition. Yeah.
It kind of felt like that. There is such a thing as pizza world championships.
Huh.
And then one day I'm going to
go.
Do you know what they win? Do you happen to know?
They win a pizza gong.
All right.
Like
nice.
A big gong. I don't know what it's for.
What do you do?
I have no idea what that means. And I just love
every
the sound about pizza gong.
It's a massive, and one of those massive vertical.
Like engraved like a pizza maybe.
No, it's just like bronze. I wish it was like a shape of a pizza.
All right. That's a pretty good prize award.
And they get a free flour. Like really high quality flour for their pizza.
That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's lifetime, and you know, it's a lot.
There's a couple handfuls of it. Here you go. Yeah.
Good job, Brain Live next year.
At the Pizza World Championship.
So if anyone out there connected with the governing body, please hook us up. Well, Karen, you set me up perfectly. You alluded to the Purple Heart and whom it is for and what
pizza?
It signifies earlier.
Yeah.
So I have a very short, short little quiz here about some of the most well-known, American military, awards and honors.
I'm gonna get wrecked.
Well, we'll see here. It was very short, very short. So yes, I know you have heard of the Purple Heart because you just talked about it. In fact, it is one of the most respected awards you can receive as a member of the U.S. Armed Forces. Two questions. One, what does it signify? What is the Purple Heart for?
You are wounded in combat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Broadly speaking, it's injury in the line of duty in combat. It can be fairly serious, too. You get multiple Purple Hearts, too. You can receive one Purple Heart per incident. Yeah, definitely. The official full definition is it is awarded for, quote, being wounded or killed in any action against an enemy of the United States or as a result of an act of any such enemy or opposing armed forces.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can receive it posthumously. A lot of people have received it posthumously. But yes, it signifies you are literally putting your ass on the line for your country. Mm-hmm. Who is depicted on the Purple Heart Medal?
Oh.
Who is on the Purple Heart?
Is it just based on color? Is it Grimace? Grimace on?
It is a little more solemn and serious than Grimace.
Is it like an actual person?
It is a famous
person.
It is a famous American.
Is it a president?
It is a president.
George Washington.
It is George Washington.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's important.
He is fairly important. And in fact, the badge of military merit, which was sort of considered the forerunner of the modern Purple Heart, was established by George Washington way back when he was leading the Continental Army. And it was a very, very selective award. They say he only gave it out apparently to only three soldiers from the Revolutionary War. So So it's, I mean, and of course, you know, flash forward to today, it's been awarded just under 2 million times now.
So is there, even say if I get like my pinky blown
off. Oh, you got a hangnail?
Yeah, or like, I mean, is there a degree of woundedness?
There is a degree of woundedness. Yeah, yeah. If you're getting, you know, paper cuts, filing documents, they're not going to necessarily consider
that. I think that
yeah.
you're like, I don't want to mangle this up, but I think that like your supervisor or your commanding officer like has to sign off.
You generally need to be recommended for it. Got and it. Then, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. You don't just like when you come out of the hospital and say, hey, so where's my purple heart? Yeah, right. Okay. Right. Yeah,
that's what I thought.
One of the few honors and medals higher than the Purple Heart is the Medal of Honor, often called the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Okay,
that is not actually its full technical name. It's just the Medal of Honor. It is the highest military honor possible, awarded by the president. Only U.S. servicemen and women are eligible to receive it. And it is basically just for outstanding acts of valor. Mm-hmm. How many versions of the Medal of Honor are there?
What do you mean?
How many? Well, I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
Not everyone receives the same version.
Yeah. Ah. There's like a...
Chris.
4.
Incorrect.
Dang.
I know there's a silver one and a bronze one, right? Or like two. There are at least two, because when I did the research on the Navajo wind talkers...
There are more than two.
There were two different ones that they got.
All right, I'll say there are at least two.
Three. Two plus.
There are three.
Magic number. Magic trivia number.
Yep.
There are three versions. There's the Army Medal of Honor. Mm-hmm. There's one for the Navy the Air Force. This kind of sucks.
Coast Guard?
I was four. Well, the Marines.
Both the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard receive the Navy version of the Medal of Honor, which, you know, is nice, and I won't presume to speak for them.
Nobody went home going, I only got the Navy version.
Exactly.
Why is it the Navy version and not just the aquatic soldier version?
Did you know it is against the law to wear a Medal of Honor if you have not been awarded it? They take it very seriously. Huh. There are a number of laws against who exactly is allowed to don the Medal of Honor.
Well, what happened? What are they going to do?
They could fine you.
Okay.
Yeah? The full qualification for the Medal of Honor is, quote, conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty. Takes it seriously.
Said a lot of video game titles, man.
Medal of Honor, Call of Duty. Yeah.
They just go through the Army manuals whenever they need franchise titles.
On the battlefield.
I'm waiting for this this year's release of Gallantry and
Intrepidude.
Yeah.
All right, last one. Who is the only U.S. president to have been awarded the Medal of Honor?
Oh.
And I'll tell you, it's not George Washington. I will rule one out for you. I think that was Dana.
Is it Eisenhower?
It is not Eisenhower. Mm. It was a former military man. Yeah.
Okay.
It was awarded posthumously, if that helps you. Karen.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes.
He seems like a fighting kind of.
Intrepid.
Yeah, intrepiditude.
Yeah. Yeah. It was actually awarded by President Bill Clinton in 2001.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, primarily for his service in the Spanish-American War.
Huh. Why did it take so long?
Well, you know, I mean, I think...
Other stuff to do.
He was like president. It was aren't you winning enough?
Right.
Games?
Yeah. Even in death, do you need this?
He's on Mount Rushmore. He's
but
fine.
I did not come here to impugn the spirit of the great president Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, they named the teddy bear for Teddy Roosevelt? He's fine. Yeah. He has enough awards.
They did name the teddy bear for Teddy Roosevelt.
He's covered.
Yeah.
So let's loop back around to entertainment.
Yeah.
We can't escape awards so easily. I want to talk about EGOTs. Well, we've talked about it before on the show.
Yeah.
EGOT is
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. Mm-hmm. As of when I checked, there were 12 people who've gotten the EGOT.
Oh man, I thought there were like at least 30. I don't know.
No. It doesn't happen
that
often. Select company.
And, you know, people, there's varying levels of enthusiasm for this award. They're like, oh, it doesn't often really encompass the spirit of each award. Like you win for spoken word on a Grammy.
Oh, yeah,
it's a lot of
technicalities.
It's
right?
technicality.
Yeah. Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Somebody was saying Mel Brooks is maybe the first one who really qualified, like, one for what the spirit of each award was.
Right.
So exclusionary.
It's so exclusive. Legend goes, and this is probably true, it seems like it comes up everywhere, that it was coined by Philip Michael Thomas of Miami Vice. He was not the main guy. He was the other guy.
Tubbs.
And in the 80s. Yeah.
He was Tubbs.
Yeah.
Who's the main guy?
Crockett.
Don Johnson?
Don Johnson.
Okay, Johnson. Wow. Not Don Johnson.
Man, this is like Wham. Like, I remember George Michael, but I have no idea who he is.
So imagine Andrew Ridgely is like, I'm going to get an EGOT.
The Andrew Ridgely of police shows.
Of Miami. So he got a medallion in the 80s, and he'd go around, and he said, I'm going to EGOT. And he had a record out.
Okay.
He would go on shows. You got to watch. He's fascinating. I watched his interview with Johnny Carson, and I was like, yeah, that guy coined EGOT. I believe it.
Yeah.
Like, but did he actually get an EGOT?
No.
Well,
no.
He's not even close.
Oh. He didn't get any of them.
He didn't win any of them. But I like the spirit.
Yeah.
He came up with the name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a shiny medallion to show for it.
Anyway, I have a quiz for you guys about people who have almost EGOTed.
All right.
Whoa. Oh, okay.
Now it's a verb.
EGOTed.
Yep. So these people are all one award short of getting an EGOT. And so the way it's structured is I'll give you the three awards that they've won. Like maybe they've won a lot for the Emmys or something, but I'll only tell you one of the titles that they won for the Emmys. And then you tell me who it is based on these three things that they were in.
Okay. And do we have
in enough that they won an award for?
Okay.
Oh, do you want to write down?
Yeah, let's write down close.
Actually, okay. Yeah, let's do that. So these people are one award away from having
egos, or toes.
Toes.
Yeah. All right. First person won an Emmy for Outstanding Variety Musical or Comedy Special for the Farewell Tour, a Grammy for Best Dance Recording for Believe, and an Oscar for the Best Actress in Moonstruck.
Oh.
Does not yet have a Tony.
Wow, I didn't know she's close.
Everyone said Cher. It's Cher.
Cher and Cher alike.
That's right.
So she's missing Tony.
She's just missing a Tony. That could totally happen.
That could happen.
She could do it.
All right. Next one. So this person won a Grammy for Best Pop Performance by a Duo or Group. That's what Friends are for. The Best Original Song, Can You Feel the Love Tonight? From The Lion King, an Oscar. And a Tony for Best Original Score for Aida.
What was the first one?
It was That's What Friends Are For. Pop duo.
Oh, this is a pop duo? No. It's a person.
This person won a Grammy.
A Grammy.
But as a part of a
song. Okay, yes. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Everyone had, wait, what is Chris? Tim Rice. But Colin and Karen said Elton John. It's Elton John.
Oh, okay.
From the, I put the, Can You Feel the Love Tonight?
I know. Well, I was going for the. Well, I mean, Tim Rice did Can You Feel the Love Tonight and Aida, I think.
And the lyrics to Aida. Right, he's the lyricist. Right, yeah.
This person won Emmy for Supporting Actress in Downton Abbey, an Oscar for Best Actress in The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and a Tony for Best Actress in a Play, Lettuce and Lovage. Maggie Smith. Good job, you guys.
Dame.
Maggie Smith.
Sorry. And Sir Elton John.
You're right.
We're going to
check that attitude.
Titles.
You're right.
Yeah. Okay. How about this? He won an Emmy for Lead Actor in a Miniseries or Movie for Angels in America, an Oscar for Best Actor in Scent of a Woman, and a Tony for Best Supporting Actor in a Play, Does a Tiger Wear a Necktie?
That's a weird.
That is quite a play's name, yeah. Right? Al Pacino. Yes, Al Pacino. Good job. These are too easy. I'm going to go to a harder one.
Does a tiger wear a necktie?
I need closure
on that anecdote.
All right. He won an Emmy for lead actor in a miniseries or movie for The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, an Oscar for Best Actor in Shine, and a Tony for Best Lead Actor in a play called Exit the King.
What was the first one again?
It was The Life and Death of Peter Sellers. All right.
Okay.
Yes. Chris and Karen say Jeffrey Rush, and Colin says.
Nah, just Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff
I just
Goldblum.
Had to write something down. That's right.
Yeah, it was a Jeff.
Yeah.
I almost give you half points for that. She won an Emmy for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series, Sex in the City, a Grammy for Best Spoken Word Album in Inconvenient Truth, and a Tony for Best Actress in a Play, Rabbit Hole.
Supporting.
Colin and Chris say Sarah Jessica Parker. Karen says Cynthia Nixon. It is Cynthia Nixon.
Yes!
Yeah, not Lee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Booyah!
I wouldn't have been able to think of her name.
I don't even know which one she is.
The old one.
No.
Oh. She's Miranda.
She's Miranda.
She's Miranda.
You're such a Miranda, Chris.
Yeah. She also won an Emmy for her guest role on SVU, and I almost that, but I was like, that's so inside baseball. I'm not gonna. Yeah. Okay. Let's do two more. He won an Emmy for Outstanding Directing for a Drama Series for Boardwalk Empire, a Grammy for Best Music Film, No Direction Home. I didn't even know what a music film was. And an Oscar for Best Director of The Departed.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Everyone says Martin Scorsese. Everyone is correct.
Oh, I spelled it wrong.
I want to give Chris. No, I want to give Chris
Marty.
A point for Marty. For
you
Marty.
Said Marty. Yeah.
Yeah, we're just, well, you know, we're like this.
Yeah. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah. I see you, Chris.
Finally, she won Outstanding Writing in a Comedy Variety or Music Special for the Paul Simon Special. She won a Grammy for the Best Comedy Album for This Is a Recording. And she won Best Actress in a Play, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe.
This is almost
okay.
You got.
Say those again.
Yeah. She won an Emmy for the Paul Simon Special, a Grammy for Best Comedy Album, This Is a Recording, and a Tony for The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe.
Oh.
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. So Colin and Karen say Lily Tomlin. It's Lily Tomlin.
Yeah.
Yeah. She won a bunch of Emmys for her own comedy specials, but I was like, that's pretty.
Yeah. She won for the Lily Tomlin show.
Yeah. Right.
I wonder who that is.
So looking at this list, if I had to put my money on someone to complete it first, I think I would probably put man, that's a tough one.
I'd put it on Cher.
I was going to say Cher or maybe Al Pacino.
Since we're already talking about this, who are some EGOT winners? I believe Whoopi Goldberg.
Mel Brooks. Whoopi
Audrey Goldberg. Hepburn.
Robert Lopez.
Bobby Lopez. Yep.
Audrey Hepburn.
Ah.
I think Streisand is one as well.
Okay.
Lin-Manuel Miranda
She's
is
definitely
on his,
got
on his
the
way.
Academy Award and the Grammy.
Some of the people on the list for EGOTs, though, are on there because they were awarded, like, oh, you're so cool awards, you know, like Lifetime Achievement or like
not for like a competition.
Yeah.
So we need the REGOT with the Razzie in there. Halle Berry, get on it.
I know. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Ooh, the REGOT.
Oh, man. On our way. You know what? With this list, we can do some REGOTs.
Or the Toger.
The Toger.
The Toger.
The Toger.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I'm at a grade school in Chicago. We're going to find out if these teachers listen to Good Job Brain. Emperor Qin Shi Huang ruled China until his death in 210 BC. How did he die?
I'm going to go with B.
Oh, it's definitely C. He was crushed.
Mercury poisoning, D.
Ding, 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 ding.
No way.
Way.
Awesome.
Betty White or penicillin?
Which came first? No, penicillin.
That's crazy.
So you would learn all of these things if you listened to Good Job Brain.
I should. I will.
And we're back, and this week we're talking about prizes.
Back in the Stone Age of Good Job Brain, in February 2013, we had an episode about the circus, which I think everybody
remembers. Stone microphones.
Yes. With the little, it was great because we had the little, you know, the dinosaur running on the treadmill to power the mixer.
Yeah.
It was like, it's a living.
It's a living.
Karen, you talked about during the circus episode, carnival scam.
Yeah.
Games, like carnival games and how they are rigged to be very unwinnable, such as all you have to do is throw this basketball into this hoop, but you can't see from where you're standing that the hoop is actually oval. And the basketball, it will not go in the hoop. This was February 2013. We talked about this, and we tried to warn you, Planet Earth, but you just didn't listen, and our message did not reach as far and wide as we hoped, because not 2 months after that episode aired, about 2 months after that episode aired, tragedy in the form of a very large and slightly racist stuffed banana.
Oh.
A man from Epsom, New Hampshire. This was interesting to me. I have relations in Epsom, New Hampshire. It's less than 5,000 people. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I know people there. man from Epsom, New Hampshire, no relation to me, went to one of those carnivals, one of those traveling carnivals, played a carnival game called Tubs of Fun.
Okay.
Tubs of Fun.
It sounds fun. I
like a lot
it.
Of yeah, carnival games. Yeah. It is deceptively simple. You get two balls, like softballs, like a, like, okay. like not baseballs, but softballs about that size. And there's an off the shelf plastic tub, the sort of thing you buy to put, you know, one of those
like
blue
an ice tub
plastic,
or something.
An ice tub. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's riveted onto a platform that's sort of like 45 degrees. So it's basically pointed at you. What you have to do is you have to throw the ball in the tub and have it stay in there and not bounce out of the tub back at you. And this guy, Henry Gribham, he was not able to do it in the first try. And then he tried a few more times and couldn't do it. And the way he told the story afterwards was that he got so mad that he couldn't do it and that he had spent so much money trying to just throw the ball into the tub and it keeps bouncing out. He starts betting the operator like, I want to go double or nothing that
Whoa.
I can do it this time.
Okay.
And he ends up very, very, I mean, again, we've talked about, I think, on a different episode, like loss aversion. Like when you go down in terms of money, when you've blown $100, you want to get the money back.
Yeah.
So apparently the operator was like, yeah, you know, I'll bet you double or nothing you know, can do it. And then he loses more money, loses $300 at the carnival.
Oh my God.
In a very short amount of time playing Tubs of Fun. And he goes, and he goes home.
Okay.
Where he retrieves $2,300 from his house.
No.
All his money. And takes it to the carnival and then blows $2,300 on Tubs of Fun. And he walked away. He won a prize. He won a Rastafarian banana, a gigantic stuffed banana.
What did he win it for?
It might have been a consolation prize.
Yeah,
the guy gave him the banana.
I think
he was
banana.
Trying to win an Xbox 360 with a Kinect camera. This is in the year 2013 when that was like worth something. This ends up on the local news that this had happened. And he was basically complaining, you know, there's no way that this game isn't rigged. This game is rigged. There's no way it's not rigged. Because whenever I threw a practice shot, the ball stayed in the tub. And then whenever it was real money on the line, the ball bounced out.
Huh.
So he believed that
the operator
was
pressing a button
exactly,
or
something.
Something
is going on. So is he right? In a manner of speaking, you might actually say that he's wrong because there is no secret mechanism. It's all exactly as it appears to you. He's just not noticing something. So you go up to the game and the operator says, all you got to do is toss the ball in the tub. The operator is standing behind the counter, right? And he's standing sort of to the side of the tub and he just sort of gently puts the ball in the tub. He's like, all you got to do is put a ball in the tub. And then he goes, here you go. Take a practice shot on the house, and he hands you the second ball, and you throw the ball in, and it stays in. And he's like, that's how easy it is, folks. You throw it in, it stays in. You want to do it? You're a natural.
Is the ball
you got
different?
This. Win a prize.
No.
The ball's not different.
There
I think
two
it just
balls
you know,
sometimes,
it dampens the vibrations.
Sometimes they switch out balls and things like that. And yeah, then he takes the balls out, and he hands them to you, and he goes, here you go. And
that's
you throw the one ball in, it bounces right out. You throw the second ball in, bounces right out. But you know you just threw one in, and it stayed in there. So you know you can do it. You're so close, so why don't you keep doing it? So Colin, yeah, absolutely.
When there's a ball in there,
there's
the other one it'll stay. It won't
it
vibrate
does.
As much.
So, you know, he puts a ball in there gently, and then he gives you the second ball and says, here, take a practice shot. You throw it in, it stays in because the ball that's already in there, it deadens the whole system. It makes it less bouncy because it absorbs a lot of the vibrations
the
that are going
no.
on. So you throw the second ball in there, it stays in. It is a con game. Don't do Tubs of Fun. Don't do
don't
it.
Don't do any of the
don't
hard
do
work.
It.
Could
well,
you just
I mean,
be like, I'll leave the ball
some,
in there.
You know what they say is play carnival games where it's and you
like, well.
Versus other people. So there's always somebody will win. But the Tubs of Fun
like those
thing
water gun
that
things.
Is a con game. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right.
Now, there is a sort of a happy ending. The film of the guy walking around with a giant Rastafarian banana went viral. And collegehumor.com offered to purchase the banana from him.
Oh.
By the way, when this was happening, I saw a lot of news stories referring to it as a life-sized banana. No, it's not a life-sized
like
banana.
Like a person.
It's a man-sized banana. But it's not a life-sized banana would be a regular
just
small banana.
Just a tiny
banana.
Little banana, yeah. Yeah. right. Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
say, not
a tiny
this.
Little dreadlocks. Yeah.
The collegehumor.com offered to purchase the banana from him for $2,600 plus an Xbox with a Kinect.
Good on them. Good on
a happy ending. In after a fashion, racist banana gets a forever home. and everybody learns a good lesson.
Yeah.
Karen, you and I were talking before the show about other games that were out there that we didn't cover, and there's one, like, literally, if you want to play Tubs of Fun, I guess go ahead at this point, but really, really, really never play this game. Never play the game called Swinger or any sort of variations of it. This is where you have a bottle, like a milk bottle or a bowling pin, probably a bowling pin. Mm-hmm. It's where you have a bowling pin. And you have a bowling ball that's on a rope that's attached to a point on the ceiling. And the object of this game, and of course the operator will come out and will show you that he can do it very easily, is to swing the ball past the bowling pin and have it come back and knock the bowling pin down on the return. Right?
Okay. Okay.
And he will show you that he can absolutely do it. And then when he sets up the pin for you, he will put the pin directly underneath, right in line with the point at which the ball is roped onto the ceiling.
Oh.
Which makes it not only difficult, mathematically impossible for you to, because if you swing the ball on one side, it will come back on the other side of the pin. Not slightly, it will come back the exact same distance on the other side because it will describe a perfect parabola around
geometry.
The pin. It's not because so never, ever, ever. That is a con game.
It's really interesting, as you say, the difference between the fair, not fair ones and the unfair, not fair ones.
Right. Like the basketball hoop thing with the oval basketball.
You can't do
hoop.
It.
Like you could do it. It's just, it tricks you into thinking that it's easier than it is.
All right. I have a quiz for you. And of course, when we talk about prizes, my first thing that comes to mind is, I always think like blue ribbon winners, giant vegetables and fruits, like at county fairs.
Yeah.
And I've been to a couple of, a county fair is now and here.
Ugliest dog.
That's near us. That's in Marin County.
Oh, right.
Ugliest dog. Here I have a quiz and it's a write down quiz. And I've picked a world record breaking large vegetables and fruit.
Okay.
And I will give you most of these are you have to guess the weight. The recorded weight. Closest to gets the point. And I'll tell you in both imperial and metric
and
version.
Other. Yeah.
And other. Here we go. Let's just go with the heaviest cabbage. Mm. How much do you think the heaviest cabbage weigh? This is in Alaska at a county fair there. Average cabbage is about like a head of cabbage is about 2 pounds. This is a world record.
World record cabbage.
Heaviest cabbage. It's so big. All right. Not Price is Right.
Okay.
So closest
okay.
to.
Okay. All right.
Answers up for your guess for biggest cabbage. Dana says 600 pounds.
Could be.
Chris says 55 pounds. And Colin says 17 pounds.
I feel good about this.
Chris is the winner. The largest cabbage weighs 138 pounds, and that's 62 kilograms.
Wow.
That's a person made out of leaves.
Mm. I'm thinking about the giant pumpkin scale.
Yeah.
I think there's the giant pumpkin, I think, is
like 2,000
dense.
Pounds or something.
Yeah, I mean, because cabbage is still a bunch of leaves.
That's a life-sized cabbage.
Yeah, life-sized cabbage.
Yeah, speaking of life-sized produce.
Yep. Let me tell you, Karen. That's a lot of coleslaw.
That is. I actually did some follow-up. That cabbage was shredded down for feeding farm animals and compost.
Oh, okay.
Because just at one point, even the farmer says, when it grows so big, the taste is diluted.
Ah, okay.
So
it tastes like nothing.
Yeah. All right. World's heaviest broccoli. Also, another Alaskan county fair winner. Well, I don't have an average broccoli weight. I tried looking for it. Heaviest broccoli.
Okay.
Broccoli is pretty light because it's a lot of florets and air, you know, so the really heavy part is the stalk.
I feel like it's denser than cabbage.
Yeah.
Only the stalk part, though, not the
flower
fuzzy
buds.
Head part. Yeah.
All right. Heaviest broccoli. Answers up. Dana says
80
pounds. Colin says 34 pounds. Chris says 178 pounds. The answer is 35. 5 pounds. Oh. Colin gets the point.
One off.
Close.
Wow.
35 pounds, that is 15.8 kilograms. And so both of these, cabbage and broccoli, is grown in Alaska. And Alaska actually has a kind of, not magic, but,
oh, it's not
there,
magic.
There is a reason why, because they have longer daylight during the summer. So there's 20 hours of
cheating sunlight.
Well, I mean, that helps, but also, I mean, these are only specific types of vegetables that really thrive. It's not like they're just growing random seeds. Like, these seeds are researched and
pedigree.
Lines and lines.
They're trying.
Pedigree.
They're trying.
Yeah, they're trying.
That's a lot of broccoli cheese soup.
Are you going to end all of these?
Wait, you're going to make it fit.
All right.
Oh, no.
stay tuned.
World's largest pumpkin.
Oh.
World's largest pumpkin. Your average pumpkin is 18 pounds or about 8 kilograms. Listeners, I hope you guys are also writing in your answers. I want to, you know.
While driving.
Well, I prepared both metric too.
Oh yeah, right. Yep.
For the non-US, world's largest pumpkin. This one's big.
Okay,
Dana
all right.
says 2,200 pounds.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Colin says 999 pounds, and Chris says 301 pounds. Mm-hmm. The answer is 1,689 pounds.
Yeah.
That's 766 kilograms.
I know they had to use like a forklift. Like, I've seen them like bring in this thing with equipment.
How much is a ton?
2,000.
So it's like almost a ton of pumpkin.
That's a big pumpkin pie.
All right, here we go. Let's move away from weight and let's guess the longest carrot. The longest carrot, you guys.
Oh, man. All right.
Longest carrot. Your usual carrot is about 12 inches, 25 centimeters. Not baby carrots, obviously. Normal carrots. Longest carrot. And this is interesting because I had to bring up how they grew it.
That's a little bit of a
sounds
hint,
weird, yeah.
It?
No, I'm imagining like this pipe that runs through the
world's longest carrot. Answers up. Here we go. Dana says 4 feet and 2 inches. Colin, 60 inches.
So
5 feet.
No okay. Units on that.
I'm covering my bases.
60 feet. Yeah.
Chris says 7 feet, 2 inches. The answer is 19 feet and 2 inches.
Oh.
So that's you, I think, Chris.
I think
that's
it's Chris. Me. Yeah, I think it's me. Yeah.
19 feet, 2 inches. 5.8 meters. That's a long carrot. And so how they grow it is it grows on an angle. It grows on a 45 degree like platform, you know, not underground.
Oh,
yeah,
out?
It's out like in the greenhouse. I also looked up heaviest carrot, and I didn't include this because the world's heaviest carrot, or the world series, like all the other contenders of heaviest carrot, it's not one giant carrot. It looks like it's a bunch of carrots growing into a Franken carrot.
Ooh. Yeah.
You know, so when you like pull in dirt, it's not one clean, nice carrot. It's all gnarly and it just looks like a bunch of carrots grew fused into each other.
These roots.
Yeah.
Kind of poking out.
So I was like,
That's a tall carrot cake.
All right. Let's do one more. The tallest sweet corn or maize, your usual edible corn plant. Tallest, okay. Not
Are
the cob. Yeah, the stalk.
The
whole thing.
Starting from the dirt up to the sky.
From the stem, to the very, very top. And your average corn plant is about 5 feet to 12 feet. That's about 1.5 meters to 3.5 meters.
12 feet is average.
Yeah. 5 to 12.
An elephant's eye is about 9 feet.
Curvature of the earth.
Yeah. Carry the 7.
All right.
All right, answer is up. Dana has
24
feet. Colin says 13 feet. Chris says 21 feet. The answer is 35 feet.
Yes.
Woo, which is about almost 11 meters
Man.
Long. That's without falling, too. I don't know how they not fall.
So you put 13 feet, and she said the cap for average was 12 feet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I zoned out there. I was too busy trying to picture, like,
a
corn. I was thinking, like, 10 feet. I was,
That is one big taco.
all the stuff isn't a fluke. Like all of these large produce things.
No, this is intentionally.
This is intentionally to be comically large. Well, good job, you guys.
Cool.
Is it a tie?
Trip to the county fair. Oh,
We're just going to call it a tie.
Dana and Chris. And we got one last chance to win a prize.
Well, no prizes here being given out on the show, but I do have a tale for you guys that involves gold, Nazis, cross-border intrigue, and no fewer than 5 Nobel Prize winners.
Whoa!
He's pitching a movie.
Yeah.
Was this made into a movie before?
No, but maybe this tale can be made into a movie.
Hmm. Give Colin a ring.
Yeah, Hollywood. Yeah, I've got the details.
so does the internet.
Right. You know. This story all started with a man named Karl von Ossietzky. And Karl von Ossietzky was a German journalist and political writer. He was a pacifist. He was opposed to the Nazi Party. And in 1935, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, primarily for his work exposing illegal government activities in the run-up to World War II. Ossietzky had been convicted of espionage and treason in 1931. So you can imagine that this was rather embarrassing to the German government to have their political prisoner being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, they couldn't, of course, prevent the committee from awarding him the prize, but they could sure as hell prevent him from leaving the country to go pick it up, to claim any of his money, anything like that. They're like, no way. You cannot go claim this prize and embarrass us even further. So long story short, this was scandalous both in and outside Germany. And in fact, shortly afterward, the German government outright banned German citizens from accepting any future Nobel Prizes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were not messing around. Now, so if you were a prominent scientist in Germany in the mid to late 1930s.
Those are your chances.
Right. And, you know, especially if you were Jewish, you could expect to come under an incredible amount of scrutiny from the government, as it was. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, a lot of the country's top scientists were pretty outspoken in their, they had a platform and they were pretty outspoken in their opposition to the Nazi Party and the direction the country was going, you know, and indeed, I mean, a lot of the top minds, you know, Albert Einstein among them, basically just said, see ya. I'm going to maybe come back to Germany someday, but now is not the time. And they left the country altogether. So if you were a prominent physicist or chemist who had decided to stay in Germany for whatever reason, you know, it was a little bit of an awkward position, especially if you had already won a Nobel Prize in the past, you know? I mean, they can't revoke it from you. You've got it, you know, and it's sitting in your possession before the government came to power. But the medal itself was certainly something that the government could come and basically take from you at any time if they wanted to. You know,
they can't take away your title, but they can take away the swag.
That's right. Mm. They absolutely could. And so, in fact, some high-profile scientists who had won Nobel Prizes, you know, in the 20s, 30s, in the run-up to this rise of the new government, decided, all right, you know, let's get them out of the country. Let's put them somewhere safe. And so a couple of scientists left them in the care of the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen.
Okay.
Very famous institute named after a very famous scientist, Niels Bohr, who himself was a Nobel Prize winner. Then, I mean, as it is now, it's one of the world's most prestigious, most respected research institutions, dedicated primarily to physics. And over the years, a lot of scientists had worked there, researched there. Seemed like a nice, safe, trusting place to keep your valuable gold medals out of the hands of the Nazis. And that was all well and good until 1940, when, if you know your history, you know that is when the German army invaded Denmark. So understandably, there were a lot of people who were getting very nervous. And, you know, one thing to note, this is very important, is that at the time, it was a pretty serious crime to transport gold out of Germany.
Are Nobel Prizes made of gold?
They are made of gold.
Oh!
Yes. So not just the political act of the Nobel Prize, but just any amount of gold, if you're transferring out of the country, that was a very big deal, especially if it was something so charged. You know, each Nobel medal has the winner's name on it. So it's not, that's not mine. You know, that's some other Niels Bohr. That's not me. So not only the people who had smuggled them out, but the people holding them could be in trouble too now that the Germans had occupied Denmark. So, You may not have heard of George de Hevesi, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, because clearly I had not heard of him before I first heard this story.
Is he Danish?
He was Hungarian by birth. He was living in Copenhagen, working at the Niels Bohr Institute at this time. And he proved to be a Nobel Prize-saving hero. At that time, the Institute was holding on to Nobel Prizes belonging to the medals, belonging to Max von Laue and James Frank. Who had both won prizes earlier in the teens and the 20s, and sent them to the Niels Bohr Institute for safekeeping. So George de Hevesi decided, I'm going to keep these medals safe. So Karen, yeah, let's talk about the medals here for a minute. They, you know, I mean, when you win the Nobel Prize, you get a nice fancy piece of paper, you get a nice fat check, you get a trip to Stockholm or Oslo, depending on which prize you get, and you get the medal. And up until the 1980s, these medals were pretty weighty. They were nearly pure gold. They were 23 karat gold, up through the 80s. They were about 7 ounces. These are nice, hefty, nice chunk of gold.
Yeah.
These days they're 18 karat gold plated in 24 karat gold.
Also, they keep better too.
Yeah. Like, it keeps better. Yeah. Yeah. It's a little more durable. You're right.
When you have like a lot of gold that's malleable.
It's true.
And then it's like,
it's
with
true.
The weather.
It's true. No, you're right. But in the 30s and 40s, certainly they were still virtually solid gold. And so why is gold valuable? I mean, yeah, it's pretty and it's really malleable and you can do a lot of stuff with it. But one of the reasons that gold's been so valuable is because it doesn't tarnish. It doesn't rust. It seems like it's almost magical. It doesn't react in the presence of most chemicals. Most chemicals.
Is that why?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons gold's been extremely valuable. It's, you know, I mean, going way back. You can see why alchemists wanted to turn things into this substance.
Okay.
Have you guys ever heard of aqua regia?
No.
Aqua regia.
Maybe I've
somewhere.
Heard that word, but yeah.
Sounds like a very kind of old-timey alchemist word, and in fact it is. Aqua regia means royal water, king's water. And aqua regia, scientifically, it's a mixture of nitric acid and hydrochloric acid. Now, each of these are pretty powerful acids on their own, but when you mix them together, the powers combine to do something very special and seemingly magical. Aqua regia can dissolve gold. So let's go back to 1940 in Denmark. We're at the Bohr Institute. That old cliche.
Yeah.
So George de Hevesi and Niels Bohr himself were discussing, what are we going to do with these medals in their care? You know, we don't want the Nazis to find them. We don't want anyone to get in trouble if they do find them. So de Hevesi is writing, I suggested that we should bury the medal, but Bohr did not like this idea as the medal might be unearthed. I decided to dissolve it. So yes. Chemist.
This nutty guy decided to.
Chemist by training, putting his science powers to work. He got some aqua regia. He literally put the two gold Nobel medals into the aqua regia, dissolved them into solution. As he's writing, he's like, while the invading forces marched in the streets of Copenhagen, I was busy dissolving Laue's and also James Frank's medals. So it took some time. It took a little bit of work, but he got them completely dissolved into solution. So he takes the aqua regia gold medal solution, puts it in a very nondescript jar, puts it up on a shelf in his lab, along with all kinds of other chemicals and nondescript jars. That's right.
Holy cow.
And left it there. The Germans, sure enough, did come to the Niels Bohr Institute, did come searching the Niels Bohr Institute for anything that they thought was valuable or could be politically helpful.
Oh my goodness.
And had no idea that this jar containing two melted down gold medals is waiting there just under their noses. After the war is over, all right.
Germans
are beaten. Nazis lost. Yeah. Yes. Right.
He's got to give it back to the winners.
De Hevesi goes back to his lab once things are open, goes back into his room on the shelf. The jar is still there, undisturbed, hasn't been touched since he put it there, gets it back down. Uses his vast chemistry knowledge, and he precipitates the gold back out of solution. So he now has a not in
ball gold.
It's not, you know, it's actually kind of like a powdery. Yeah, it's like a precipitate. If you're, you know, remember your high school chemistry, maybe.
No.
And he delivers the precipitated gold back to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, and sure enough, the Nobel Foundation recycled it. Reminted new Nobel medals for Max von Laue and James Frank.
Oh my.
That is incredible.
How awesome is that?
Yeah.
That's
Man.
Science power. I love it. possibly because of the good karma, possibly because he was a really smart dude. George Tavesi also went on to win his very own Nobel Prize.
For doing this?
For, can, not for this.
I would give him one for that, yeah.
Just a few years later. And I'm sure he kept it in a safe place, wherever, whatever he...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, isn't that
That's
incredible?
That is,
man, this
ridiculous.
Story could have gone so many ways. I thought it was... He'd just be like, let's dissolve it. Sorry, winners.
Right.
We gotta save our hides, you know? Or maybe he goes back to winners and be like, well, here's your jar of dissolved solution.
This is the best I could do for
you. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Science.
And that is our episode. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learn a lot of stuff about EGOTs, Razzies, pizza, and dissolving gold, not melting gold, dissolving gold. You can find our show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, Spotify, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.